This is Andrew Samuels, March 23rd, 1991. Fathers, tape 3 of 3.
And as I was really admitting, Randall put it very well in relation to eroticism, I hope I'm doing it better in relation to aggression. It's an attitude to aggressive process within the sun. And what form, in terms of an image, I'm also trying to give people what I think they've indicated they like, what form does that take? My image is, there is a kind of offering of your body as a father, as a kind of target for aggression, but not in a kind of all-knowing, liberal, over-liberal parental way, like, I know the boys want to fight me. Doing it in a way that really means you don't know how it's going to end. You don't know who's going to win. You don't know which part of his body or your body is going to be involved in this, but you offer your body as an arena, as a kind of Madison Square Garden for this thing. Now, some fathers do that. When they do that, they may be being rather nasty, conservative, prohibitive fathers. They may not be being sort of say yes fathers that we'd all like to be or like to have had. It may well be that we must get rid of the sort of conventional attitude that looks for some liberally acceptable father in this. That aggressive playback may involve a passionately prohibitive father offering himself as the arena, let's say, in which aggressive transformation can take place. And of course, Eric's father, Victor, just didn't do that. Perhaps I, as Eric's analyst, tried a bit too hard to do that. I didn't confront him, because he was too weak a person to confront. What I tried to do was indicate to him many of the ways in which he was very aggressive towards me. He would come late. He would go and see other therapists. He would want to be hypnotized. All this was sort of, you know, go back to our earlier classification, kind of schizoid aggression, nudge, nudge, nudge. You know? But by the way, what do you know about hypnotism? And I read in a book that so-and-so says, nothing you can quite put your finger on, you know? But boy, it's done. So, you know, one received it in the class of transference. Because what I did was to say, well, actually, no, you're being aggressive towards me. And it's all right. But unfortunately, it wasn't all right. I didn't convince him that it was all right. He just got more and more frightened about his own aggression and left. So it doesn't always work. That's why it's important to bring him in. Ring any bells for anyone? Personal expression of the father who offers or doesn't offer his body.
Why is it that
oh, I see. Well, it was too soon, and nothing much changed in the way he functioned. Still had a phobia about his wife's physical health. That's really why he came. He came saying that he was unable to have sex with her because he was so repelled and frightened by her pubic hair. Very early on, he told me that he had a fantasy of amputating one of her legs and sticking out of the vagina. So, as those particular problems didn't shift, I have to say, I mean, you never know, of course, one might have sown the seed for the future, but I don't. Yes.
I'm just saying, offered by, I mean, I can understand the aggressive attack on the situation. It's a cool
business. Oh, well, I tell you, the son's genital aggression towards the father and the father's corresponding genital aggression towards the son are terribly easy to see. They consist of rivalry over the mother. Absolutely. For example, one way in which fathers express a lot of genital aggression towards their sons is to sort of rather publicly parade their sexual possession of the mother in front of the son beyond a certain point. And the way in which sons, particularly small children, express their genital aggression towards the father is very clear. You make any kind of affectionate move towards your wife or your partner, and the kid is in there, usually head first, butting the ear. Okay, I know they're busting me with the head, but I think it's particularly jealousy or impulse. Does that ring any bell? I mean, you know, just jealousy. The expression of jealousy is usually carried out by means of genital aggression. Now, my thesis here is that the father-son dyad work to move that to another part of the body, if you like, which is what the exercise I'm going to want you to do, when, probably very soon, is about. It's about moving the aggression around, getting the confidence or even the faith in the possibility that aggression can be moved around. You see, our society and hence the people living in it have lost that confidence. We no longer believe that you can get out of an aggressive rut into another style of aggression. Or we have the totally deluded fantasy that you can get out of aggression altogether into some mythic order where there's no aggression. That can't be done. What you can do is rotate it, move through the styles, get into a different, qualitatively different kind of aggression. And as I say, obviously this is true for women as well, but you can't really get at it unless you thought about it first and chose a father and son. Does that make sense?
This happens to be one of the problems that we have with children. We try to get rid of this aggression and make it very general statement. So when you said offer your body or something, you can absorb that.
Well, from my thinking about this, what I've come to see is that if a woman has the confidence that she can be a metaphorical male, then she can do everything that's required for the reasonably healthy psychological development of her son. I am absolutely fed up with our culture guilt-tripping single mothers. It's really not right. Advanced thinking for you. But anyways, it's not right. Yeah, and basing such guilt tripping on outmoded, non rigorous generalizations about what constitutes a woman psychologically speaking. Women are perfectly capable of transforming aggression. I say husbands all the time. I mean, why can a woman transform a husband's aggression but not herself? The only secret thing in these processes is two great things I've been trying to tell you. One is that you can't separate the good and the bad versions of the father because the stuff is the same stuff, and the other is that all this is desperately subversive, politically speaking. Because if you can access the right kind of aggression to go with social role that you as a woman say are trying to fulfill, or the mixture of social roles, then you have a better chance, even against the institutions. But let's do the exercise, shall we? Because then we can do this final section of the day. It takes two forms. The first is essentially mental, and the second is physical. I'd like you to uncross your legs, please. Put your feet on the ground and use the pushes apart. I would prefer it if you close your eyes, but it's not compulsory. And just pay attention a little bit to your breathing. Just try to relax a little bit. Pay attention to your breathing. Now I'm going to ask you to move aggression around your body. I want you first of all to think of verbal aggression. What was the last really aggressive thing you said to someone? In your jaw. So in fact, it's where I left it. I mean, badly or?
Mildly.
Uh-huh. Is there anything you want to say to anybody here? We'll have to leave it untransformed. Actually, that's really good. In a way, that's a kind of gift. Because that stops this becoming a kind of, you know, faith healing ceremony kind of thing. Yeah. You're stuck with it. And that's this, but
and
look.
I'll live with it.
Yeah, and you live with it. And father son dyads fail very often to do this. It doesn't mean they're failing overall if they fail in one instance. But you see, the point of the exercise, very crudely, is, I'm not saying I'm functioning with anybody's father, but it's to build up people's confidence that you can move it around. And you Americans have a lovely expression that you are standoff. Standoff. Standoff gets very accurately what the main problem with aggression is. The main problem with aggression is not aggression. The main problem with aggression is stuckness. So after you, after this punching thing, you were able to keep moving.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. You see, I think you find it in, yeah, that's right, and you find in the therapy situation that I'm talking now about male patients. Male patients can do it, even though they have totally failed to achieve this kind of movement of aggression around with their fathers. Yes. I don't ever see it. I see it as not dissipating. That's my take on it. I see the transformations as being within it, rather than between it and another state.
The work I do is and you do it bodily. And you do it, and no one dies. That's the catch for me. No one dies.
Well, it's not quite the same. I mean, I can understand what you mean with classic therapy. Body therapy or movement therapy, what you're actually thinking about is, may not be actually describing your own work. You don't dissipate it actually. You render it manageable by an effort. You don't dissipate the out of the conversation.
There is the other, it's to gain choiceful energy.
Precisely. Well, they're at one, doubtless. But I wouldn't. I really don't think that a bioenergetic. I've done bioenergetics. I don't think that aggressive energy disappears. It stays. It everything is about how you manage it, what the ego position is in relation to it, what its goal is, and so on. And what I'm saying, crucially, this is a workshop not about aggression. It's about fathers. It's within the father-son setup that what you're talking about happens. And I would say that when you as a therapist deal with this, say with a female patient or client, you're functioning as the father of whatever sex and the son of whatever sex. Which is not to say that woman-to-woman aggression is the same as man-to-man aggression. There must be this difference. There was a question over here, yes? There's a psychoanalytic reason for doing it. The word transformation in Freudian psychoanalysis has a slightly different meaning from Jungian transformation. So I've got that kind of thing in mind, which is to do with movement and qualitative change, but not a sort of transcendence. So the second reason, which is connected with the first one, is to be provocative, to talk about transformations within something rather than something being transformed into something else, really means certain rather cherished bits of Jungian theory have to be looked at critically, and I like doing that. So that I accept the main, you know, you could say, well, this by classical Jungian terminology, this is not transformation. And in a way, you're right, but it's precisely to put on the agenda, you know, whether transformation is always the highest goal in the sense of transformation into something else, or whether transformations within, this is the paradox, you know, this is the. Appreciate the paradox here. We're talking about transforming something within so that whatever is transformed is different but still aggression. Yes, I'm worried about it.
Yeah, I don't quite feel
someone
has
quality
change.
Yes.
I don't know if you all of the women in the company go through the alternative
on one another and make these loud noises and grab each other and fight out and the thing that was happening is that the, I mean, I feel it now, the sense of exhilaration, because as a woman, I had spent my life being kind of afraid of that happening rather than being prepared for it happening. And first there was this physical sense of it, the sense of exhilaration of what stayed and still is there. And I practiced it a long time ago, but I had been in a Toronto with the shift, the transformation for all of us was that now mentally we have that aggressiveness ready for us if we want it. We don't go around making loud noises and running out of the ground and turning on the and stuff. But it transforms an aggressiveness that we first experienced on a very bodily, outwardly directed level to something that.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yes. And to yell instead of to scream.
Yeah, and as anybody who's attended a basic rape protection course, you know, to overcome any scruples or worries about attacking with maximum viciousness, and the guy's genital area. I mean, there's all kinds of possible ways of understanding this idea. But very interesting, Mark, you should bring this up, because one of the things that turned me on to the idea of the father of whatever sex in relation to aggression was women's self-help martial arts type groups, where it is absolutely clear that women can teach women how to be aggressive. I mean, never mind lionesses and tigresses, ordinary middle class American and British women are as aggressive as they need to be. And that, again, you see, what you're challenging here is not only something in psychological theory, but something in social organizations that men are supposed to be inherently more aggressive, and that explains, so this nonsense of sociobiology tells us, why they have positions of power and prominence in society. You know, and then you hear all these extraordinary experiments that fetuses are accidentally over-androgenized, or androgenized for that matter, female fetuses, they'll turn out to be very aggressive women. And you think, oh my God, biologists are right, it's all my genetic, blah, blah, blah. And you read the other kind of research, which shows that fetuses are accidentally administered with overdoses of female hormones also turn into over-aggressive adults. It basically means if you tamper with people's hormonal balance, they can become aggressive. Not too surprising the result. So, I mean, you know, what's coming out of what we're saying to each other is that, again, deliteralizing this, accepting that there is a need to look through the literal filter, that aggression between men is where one starts thinking and imagining, but it's not where one finishes thinking and imagining. Where one finishes is anything. Women and men, men and women, you know? And another thing that's very, very important, of course, if one really is talking, like you be the daddy dad, if one really is talking about the father of whatever sex and whatever age, I'm sure there are a lot of people here who have learned a lot about their own aggression and getting into aggressive interactions with their children. You really do. I mean, this is where that most men, and particularly men who score 8, 9, 10 on these old men, new men, scale have to really face it, is the desire to kill the baby is absolutely enormous. And yet, where's developmental psychology's equivalent of Winnicott's list of 17 reasons why a mother should hate her baby? All we're told is that men are infanticidal. They are. But there's no reason here. You ever know that one? There's a famous paper called Hate in the Countertransference. It is absolutely brilliant paper. Misprinted in one of my books rather gloriously in the bibliography as Cats in the Countertransference. There's a sort of appropriateness, because you do wear a lot of hats in the Countertransference. But anyway, in that paper, Hate in the Countertransference, where he's trying to normalize hate, a bit the way I'm trying to normalize aggression, he does list this, do you know the thing I mean? He lists 17 reasons why a mother should hate her baby. And some friends and I have been working on a list, and we're determined at least to get to 18 for fathers. But we should look at that a little bit before moving into the very last section. The infanticidal impulse, wanting to kill your baby, throttle it, yeah, it dies. It's just me.
It's good. It's just, in my experience, it's easier to as kids get older and they start talking back to you.
much more obnoxious than I like.
Yeah, but you see, if you murder your 10-year-old, she'll tell another.
Yeah, I have a 7-year-old son.
Yeah, but it's okay, you murder him. What I mean is this. If you've got a 3-day-old baby who won't stop crying, you don't have to do very much. Do with your hand. There is such a thing as context. But there's also, as you know, pseudo-context. You know about this? Sorry, pseudo-Cotdet syndrome. Well, no. Pseudo.
We call it
sudden infant death or crib death thing. Yeah. Now, crib, it exists. And for whatever reason, no one's terribly sure. It seems to be something respiratory and so on and so on. When they were researching at the Brompton Chest Hospital, Royal Brompton Oratory Chest Hospital in London, unbeknownst, this is such an awful story, it's also kind of confidential because I was told this by the pediatric cardiologist who did this. They set up a family unit and the families lived there firstly to gain practice on the equipment, the monitoring and sensory equipment. And the video, I'm not absolutely sure why. And these are families that already had one cotton. And it's something like 15-20% of the cases in the video, one or other of the parents killing the babies. So that in fact there is cotton. Please don't misunderstand me. There really is cotton. It's not this. But this is something quite horrendous. Child murder on this kind of scale. The reason why they're not able to do anything about it is they're bound by the fucking practicalities. Isn't that awful? They felt they couldn't. What they've done, in fact, is they've confronted parents, they've arranged counselling, they've done everything humanly possible, but they are in a terribly difficult situation. These people are voluntarily harming themselves. It's a really alarming thing. Now, if that's true, and it's not just that people who volunteer for these research programs do this, but I don't know what it's like. Infanticide is a big issue. And I think that this does affect men more than women, actually. And I think what it is, of course, is that the beautiful drama of the father is reawakened by the facts, our society's insistence, if you like, that the early relationship is for the mother. Yes?
I felt it myself, seeing my father's total India here.
Yes. Yeah.
The baby also, I've seen the father sort of difficult excitement and terror.
Yeah. I know. When my son was 6 months old, I was born in the U.S. in our road. And I was throwing him up. You go, and it was fine, and so on and so on. The next thing I heard was that the woman of the house had told the patient's mind that she happened to know that I had behaved violently and inappropriately with the baby. Now, in other words, it's not just what you're saying, which is the father wants to drop them. We're very ambivalent about rough and tumble. In fact, so much so that it forced a lot of dads, when they write about being a father, possibly to over-accentuate this in a kind of somewhat defensive way. You know? People are very ambivalent about rough play. And this goes back to the offering of one's body as the arena. You know, it needn't be terribly rough. It may not even involve mock wrestling or boxing matches at all. It can be an unspoken and unenacted communication to the father and son. Anyway. But what I'd like to suggest you do before we go into the last thing is just get up and have a little stretch and move around a bit. Give each other a bit of a back rub.
Can you on, please?
Roll your back.
Here. I'm here. I'm here.
I want to do two things before throwing it open for a kind of general feedback session, which you can use any way you like. Should I wait until people come back from the laboratories or not? Perhaps I should wait a little bit. What do you think? Okay, so we'll go on till 25 to 4. I was kind of worried. You know, when I heard the energy level was going down, it suddenly shot up again. People got their second wind, or... Yeah, maybe. It's a bit like the small hours of the night. If you're doing workshops, there's always dead hours. There's nothing you can do right after lunch. I used to get around to this particular workshop by showing a video of Father's son interacting with Agnes. So it's not too boring. In fact, I managed to do a very unconscious thing. I've lost it. I've lost
the American version.
You know, we have a different video technology. You have one and we have another. So I've got the British version, but I've lost the American version. Okay, now look. I only want to say two things here. One, we've got to be careful not to ask the Father to do too much. That means accepting that there are limits to even the subversive Father, and that certain things cannot be done by Father alone, but will need to be done by other men, or, perhaps more accurately I should say, by other men of whatever sect. Whether this is buddies, brothers, mentors, elders, baby and young boys, I don't know. All I know is it's very important at the end of the workshop, sort of massive as this one is now turned into, that we rein in our desire for the Father to do all of it. He comes. That's the first point. I want to de-idealize what's been going on. So already I think I've kept it pretty realistic and close to the negative. But I want even to take it further away. Don't expect the Father to do too much. And the second thing, before I stop, pull out a chair actually, and listen to what you have to say, is this. I want to bring the mother back in, but I want to bring her back in, not in her own right, or in isolation, but in relation to the Father, to what is called the primal seed. Now, which of you know this term primal seed? You know the primal seed? We all do, yeah? No? Oh, the primal seed is the real or fantasized experience by a baby or a child of the parent's sexual relationship. Wonderfully mistyped by my colleague John Allen, Vancouver's secretary, on the program today as, I take it back, not to do it again, as the primal scent. She also misspelled psychologist, and God knows what John is doing up there. I think the primal scent. Yeah. Well, primal scent is a very, very useful. It's also one of the main issues of contention between Freud and Jung. Did the wolf man, famous case of Freud, see his parents having sex? Or did he project an inner world preoccupation of his own onto the idea of his parents having sex? And that discussion still divides not only Jungians and Freudians, but within Jungian and within Freudian circles. Anyway, the point I want to make about the parents together in bed or in their marriage and their relationship is this. When you work clinically with people, they start off by telling you they can't imagine their parents' sex life. They simply can't see how mother and father ever had sex. As they start to get into the analysis, something quite extraordinary happens. They can imagine it. They usually imagine it initially in very conventional terms. Man on top, somewhat active, and if they're honest about their fantasies, the man is being somewhat violent and he's being somewhat aggressive. Now something quite extraordinary starts to happen. As the primal scene fantasies start to develop in the analysis, the mother, the woman, starts to get more and more active. Not just gets on top in the physical sense, but gets on top in the social sense. Starts to break out of the conventional bounds of appropriate womanly behavior. Now I think that this is something to do with the Father. And that's why, although I've concentrated overwhelmingly on the Father's relationship to son and daughter, I want to end on the Father's relationship with his partner, if there is one, and if it's a homosexual situation, with the man's homosexual partner functioning as the mother of the dead sex. What I want to say is this, that there is a terrifically strong analogy to be drawn between the patient's fantasizing of the mother taking an ever more active role in the parent's sex life, breaking the rules about female decorum and sex. There's an analogy between that and women breaking out of the decorous straitjacket in society. So that somewhere along the line, if father and mother together now, neither is more responsible than the other, get involved in a vigorous intercourse in which the woman is committed to take whatever place she likes, to act out, even enact, actually better, her fantasies about her sexuality, then that can be seen as an analogy for a possible breaking out and enactment of fantasies of social and political reality. So that my small contribution here about the relationship between the father and the mother has to do once again with the movement from the internal image a person has of their parents' marital life and something in the social and political realm involving a more active and power-taking role for women. I think that sexual imagery, which has women in strong positions, is politically liberatory and very important for that reason. So just to go over it, the two things I wanted to say were, number one, don't ask the father to do too much. He can't. And number two, try to think in terms of the father in a vigorous intercourse with the mother and think of that as a symbolic version of the kinds of social and political changes, particularly affecting women and the relations between the sexes that most of us would want to see. Well, that concludes the workshop from my side. We've now got 15 minutes for people to feedback, and also because of the nature of this workshop, maybe to talk to each other a bit, because it's all been between me and individuals talking. Maybe there have been cross currents you may have things to say to me nicely, you may have personal confessions to make. Nor do you have to wait, raise your hand at this point, because I'm getting a chair and I'm going to sit down.
I want to interject the possibility, because we can offer our bodies transformation. And I think all of this work that we offer our body for a ride for that transformation.
Yes, very good.
The body works in hope and positive.
Yes.
Sometimes they're not as comfortable speaking with body and the body.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely right. And if you end up with something that doesn't look like this, then you see positive negative access. It's a lot different. Aggressive. If you really wanted the whole stuff around it, there was a problem. All there is a very simple way to understand the whole workshop, as I said earlier. It is all about raising certain things to consciousness, understanding them in a certain way, and forming that understanding into what I call a text. And that last point, making a text, is absolutely crucial. That's why at times in the workshop, I've said things with far more definitiveness than I really feel, because that's part of what texting things is about. Though I have also tried to indicate where I simply don't know. Yes, please, just go ahead.
Well, you know, I've got a feeling of having tried out the feminine role, you know, more or less by trying to get into that part. And this role of switching to a usual role that is hazardous. And that there's a difference in qualities for male aggression and male aggression. Male arises and female arises. It can't be dropped out. I think that, you know, the way the whole society is starting to function is deteriorating because of these two roles. That's just a future. What I see now is that I'm trying to get back to a more traditional sex role and really amplify those and scale it over. It works better than you can. It's economically easy. But I see what you're saying here is you want to get more of a
mixture. I'm saying something that I think for some people is emotionally very difficult. I'm saying primarily I don't know to what extent male and female versions of eroticism or aggression are the same or different. And I'm saying that it's terribly complicated and difficult for people to understand, and hence it's not exactly a vote. That we may have to live with some rather complex statement, like in some ways male sexuality and female sexuality are similar, and in some ways they are not similar, and it's up to psychologists to do that necessary work of working it out. But it's only when you get literal and metaphorical dimensions going, only when you can actually see the traditional arrangements are not God-given, but just happen to be the case, that you're intellectually and emotionally free enough, and even use a terribly, terribly loaded word, mature enough to take on board the mixture of sameness and difference.
So, I guess where I get stuck, I don't want to call it male or female.
No.
Well, he's talking about liberating from structure.
Yes, I agree. It's very interesting. You see, let's take an example like this. If a man gives a bottle to a very, very new infant, is he doing some mothering or is he doing simply some fathering? It's a completely unanswerable question because there's a richness to be found in either answer. Now, my formulation of father of whatever sex, mother of whatever sex, is not offered as a cast iron, you know, like a kind of this is the term you must use. It's offered to keep the confusion alive and yet have a conversation about it. Now, so I agree with you. You know, I prefer the liberation of involved by referring to a woman as the father of whatever sex, rather at the moment, rather than simply saying it's what a mother does. You could say it's just what men and women do, but then of course you miss the particular problems associated with being a parent. There isn't a way. I mean, but you know, what you learn from being an analyst, a clinical analyst, is that when you reach this kind of impasse and you just don't know what's going to happen next because you're stuck, that's a good place to be. People who try to foreclose this are problematic, you see.
So part of it is what you're talking about, keep the juice going.
Keep the juice going, that's very nice. That's absolutely right. And I'm in the Plural Psyche, the book I want you all to buy, no, seriously, in that I go on and on and on about the value of confusion. But you see, it has to be, this goes back to, am I a thinking type kind of thing, it has to be, if a confused person asks you to respect the value of confusion, so what? If it has to come from somebody who can be unconfused, that's the problem with this. Yeah? I mean, in other words, if I gave myself 4 on that scale, therefore what I say comes out of a certain kind of traditional male capacity. If I was 9 on that scale, even if I said just the same things, it would be a slightly different feel to it. So I like to work through and with confusion, and that's what I was trained to do as an analyst, and that's my analytic credo, not to settle things. But that, again, that's hard, man. That's really hard, particularly if you've got a crying baby or a confused toddler or an irrational 4-year-old or a boring latency child or an utterly rebellious adolescent, or indeed if you've got a son or a daughter in their 30s, 40s, or whatever. It's terribly difficult.
I think I got the aggressive feedback, a lot of feedback. You mentioned the spiritual feedback. I wonder if you could,
yes,
in a couple of sentences, tell us what that is.
Yes.
Maybe I can better myself.
Yes. Well, one of the ways I conceive of spirituality is not that it's the result of the transformation of sexual aggressive energy, but it is the result of their fusion. More and more I start to see that people, if you read major spiritual writings, you'll see that the erotic element is certainly there. There's also a certain kind of bite or snap to it. So that's one very fixed way of answering you. But you know, Jungian audience, Jungian analyst, very important for me to keep it on the level of the father's body. And the transformations within aggression idea is a very important one. But you see, the Jungian notion is that all the various avenues from libido can be organized in a kind of, you know, stacked layers. I mean, Jungian will say they don't do this, but in fact they do this. The sexuality and aggression are pretty much low-level ones. Morality and spirituality are the two higher ones. And I don't really like that. I think aggression and sexuality is just great.
Does this have anything to do with aggression being, you know, kind of a third chakra level, and then aggression can turn on the self, liberates the third chakra. That's not very.
I'm familiar with that. I'm very reluctant to organize these things higher. This isn't really feedback, these are just questions. Maybe that's a form of feedback, that there's still a hunger for interchange and exploration. Yes?
Is there a particular experience?
Yes. Well, I mean, to begin with, in terms of my own psychopathology, I suppose where in fantasy terms I would fantasize myself as a mother father figure or something of that nature. Single parents fascinate me. That would be the depth reason. There's always a personal confession element. But I guess my interest in them started by accident. I got a job doing a psychotherapy action research problem with single parents. It was financed by a large British charity that looked into children's issues. I put in an interim report after 2 years and they closed the project down. And the reason they closed the project down was because I said the following things. I said that there were no inevitable psychological damages from single parenthood per se, that money was the most needed thing. But I also said, and this was the early 70s, so it was a very dangerous thing to say, that one had to start to pay attention to people who deliberately sought single parenthood status, whether consciously or unconsciously. Now, the fact that some people were seeking single parenthood status consciously caused enormous trouble. But the fact that there were some who were seeking it unconsciously caused a riot. The simplest kind of theorizing, which is perfectly ordinary analytical stuff, was unacceptable. So they closed the project down and paid me off. Well, I got a letter at home saying, you know, if you think your research work is brilliant, you should make it into a book, but we cannot afford to be seen to be associated with such conclusions. So I'm a consultant to Gingerbread. Do you have Gingerbread here? Gingerbread is like the national network of self-help groups for single parents, and I am one of their consultants about this kind of thing. Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. But you see, there is an interesting point here. I'm going to put this in sociological terms, very, very crudely. As men earn more than women, and as economics is the main source of difficulty for single-parent families, single-parent families headed by men have less difficulties than single-parent families headed by women. Now, there's lots of ways in which that's a nonsense statement, but there's a very profound truth in that. So, and also, the other thing is, all this underclass theorizing is not attacking single fathers. It's attacking single mothers for failing to provide leadership. I mean, you know, here are the politicians. Look at them. Look at them as leaders. Look at them as cultural fathers, attacking the most vulnerable sections of the community, that's to say poor women with large families without much support, for failing to provide leadership and authority within the family. It sucks. You haven't heard the underclass theory? Oh, come on, you must have heard about this. What? No, it's a theory. It's an American theory. No one's heard about this theory? Yeah, the welfare trap stuff. And all that. Yeah. It's called the underclass. It's called the underclass theory. Yeah, it is. It is associated. It is associated with the last years of the Reagan era. Is that the point to stop? Is the time to stop? Okay, we'll stop there.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Ewing Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.